This is the DeGrassio podcast of Roman Roads Press, helping Christian families inherit the humanities. I'm Cooper Salmon. I do video production and marketing, and I'm here with my co-host, Daniel Fukushan, founder and CEO of Roman Roads.
Hello.
And today we also have in the studio with us, Dr. Mitch Stokes.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So we've got limited time. So instead of listing all of the massive number of degrees that Mitch has, I'm going to give you just a short little bio. Mitch Stokes is a senior fellow of philosophy at New St. Andrews College. He received his PhD in philosophy from Notre Dame and an MA in religion from Yale. He also holds an MS in mechanical engineering and, prior to his teaching career, worked for an international engineering firm where he earned 5 patents in aeroderivative gas turbine technology. In addition to biographies of Newton and Galileo, his books include A Shot of Faith to the Head and How to Be an Atheist. Dr. Stokes has also authored our most recent textbook, Calculus for Everyone, Understanding the Mathematics of Change.
Well, thanks, Cooper. Some of those titles have important subtitles. So How to Be an Atheist is Why Many Skeptics Aren't Skeptical Enough, and A Shot of Faith to the Head is Be a Confident Believer in Age of Cranky Atheists. So they weren't pro-atheism.
Tools. Yes, don't get the wrong idea, right, Mitch, here.
Yeah. Well,
I always have to do that. Look, I can explain.
Yes. Mitch, how does an engineer become a theologian, become a philosopher? Is this a typical path for philosophy teachers?
Yeah, that's a good question. In some ways it is, in some ways isn't. You'd be surprised at how many philosophers of the 20th century, or actually throughout Western history, were interested in mathematics, and that was in physics, the mathematics and physics of the day, and that was what drove a lot of their philosophical inquiries and research. And so in the traditional sense, no, it's very natural, but for us today, it's really not normal,
right?
Abnormal. And it was one of those things where, when I left engineering to go back to school to study religion and philosophy, my manager at the engineering firm, I explained what I was going to do, and he paused and went, "What?" I mean, that was basically, it's like kind of like, huh? Doesn't even make sense.
Yeah.
What you're saying.
So you were in an engineering firm, and then it was, went to seminary, correct?
Yeah.
And go ahead.
Yeah. So a big part of the, I mean, this is part of my temperament as well as, probably some of my training, is I tend to be kind of skeptical and maybe more than I ought to sometimes, and anti-authoritative in some ways, but lots and lots of questions while I was doing my master's in engineering. I was a Christian at that time, but going through scripture and trying to figure out how, for example, Genesis jibed with science and what I thought science said, and I just had a lot of doubts, and I went through a real crisis where I couldn't read the Bible without thinking, is this really true? Yeah, and it wasn't just science. It was things like, okay, so Samson tied the tails of all these foxes together, and but it's like, or if I'm praying, it was one of those things where I was like, am I praying to no one? Am I just making? So it was a real crisis of doubt that wasn't, I mean, it was really, I was on the edge. Mm. But one of the huge blessings is that I had friends at church who were going to seminary, and they had been they read philosophy and theology and even books on how science and scripture might interact, and they started handing me books. Mm. And that was it. I was like, I could not believe. Well, I was just, I had never heard of people asking these kinds of questions. Usually people looked at me askance at church and like, I'm just glad I believe, my questions would make people nervous. But then I found, wow, there were really a lot of people over the course of history who have asked these questions. They've been there long before I had. So that was a real eye opener. And it was a double-edged sword. Part of it was just like, this is wonderful. I was so thankful. Then at the same time, I was like, why am I just now finding this out? You know, it could have saved me a lot of trouble had I known about this. And it's not necessarily that it was other people's fault, but I didn't want people to go through this. So that was when I started thinking much more. My wife and I were praying about this over the years while I was an engineer. How can more people experience that, those questions, ask them and have them answered at least to some degree in a responsible way that builds their faith,
right,
and is just helps them to for God to be more real to them.
So you pursued theology and philosophy for yourself,
yeah,
to so answer it, your own questions.
Totally. And so after reading those, some of the things that I was handed, I was like, okay, I'm going to start taking some of those classes you guys are taking at seminary just for myself. And then that's when I, as I interacted more with the professors there and I started to see that actually a teaching career could be, you know, teaching people is something that I could actually perhaps do. It was an option. And that's what got us, my wife and I, thinking more along those lines.
So how did you come to the Christian faith? Did you grow up in the Christian faith, or did that happen later in life?
Yeah, my parents were divorced. My mom raised my brother and I, and she took us to church every week. We were involved in youth group and all that. I don't remember. I mean, a lot of this was just my fault. I was a handful, and I still apologize to my mom regularly. I'm sorry, Mom, for all that I did. But it was, I don't remember hearing the gospel, but it wasn't like I had said, oh, I don't believe. Or I mean, it was still kind of part of the background. It just had no effect at all on my life. If someone asked me if I was a Christian, I would have said, yeah. And they asked me what that means. I'm not sure I could have said, but there was a time in, my second year in college, I have no idea why, I just started reading the Bible. And then it's interesting, this is a different story. I started studying, actually doing homework. Like before that, I hadn't done that. And so around the same time, things just, God kind of changed. He just, and again, there wasn't anything that prompted that I know of. Right. And but that was where I can definitely see things taking off. And God using that.
Did some of those questions come right away, or was it more a living faith came and then you started wondering about how some of these things worked out?
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. That latter part. Okay. It's like first just not even really knowing that those questions were there, but then as I thought more about them, like, wait a second, how does this, or as I read the Bible and I started to know what was in it, and like, wait, how does that fit or what? So yeah, it was more of as I got to know what Christianity and Scripture said, the questions showed up.
And I don't think that's very uncommon, even for second generations Christians who grow up, but then they realize they're not discovering it completely from scratch. It's just their eyes are opening, and it becomes their own for them to wonder, how does that work really?
And I think a lot of times people can get really fearful of that, but it is actually something that I think most people go through to some degree or another. And probably if they didn't, that's not, there should be some of that.
Right.
And I think that's just given the way God's made us, the way he's, you know, it's a design feature for us to have to learn by wrestling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you've never wrestled with any of those questions, the chances are kind of good you haven't really thought about some of them.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right.
For me, it was as a teen, I'd start pulling books off my dad's shelf, who's a pastor. R.C. Sproul was very helpful. He has a way of explaining things. But that's not uncommon. So how do you feel like your engineering background helped you on that path in terms of, did it give you tools?
Or did it hold you back?
Or did it hold you back?
That's a great question. I think it probably did a little of both, but I would say overall it was much more beneficial. I mean, I think I got the tools not just to think analytically, and you just think in a different way. I noticed my son, one of my sons is an engineer, and watching him go through engineering and seeing how he looks at things that aren't necessarily directly related to engineering, how he thinks about theology. And you just see that there are tools there that are so great. And I'm so thankful for them. And I wish my other kids kind of had those too. They have benefits from what they're studying. You know, there's always pluses and minuses, but yeah, the other benefit, and I didn't know this at the time either, was that science and math background that was actually going to play into understanding philosophy, which was a big shocker. Like, I didn't know, and I think even a lot of philosophers don't know this. So much of Western philosophy, like I said at the beginning, was we're philosophers struggling and dealing with and being interested in the math and physics or science of the day. And once you start seeing that, and if let's say you're studying philosophy, but you don't really understand the math or the science, you're really not going to understand the philosophy like you ought to.
Right.
And vice versa, because a lot of the mathematicians and the physicists that were revolutionary from Newton to Einstein, they knew their philosophy, and their philosophy and their understanding of philosophy and philosophers guided their physics and their math.
So I was going to ask, are you a scientist or a philosopher? And why is that the wrong question? In other words, shouldn't these be staying in their lanes? I mean, philosophers, you stay in your lane. Scientists, you stay in your lane, or not.
Right. How about this? I think there's something to staying in your lane. If that's your only training. So let's say I've only been trained in math or science or only in philosophy, and I don't know, then I probably should stay in my lane. I mean, I think there's there's something to be said for that, but that gets us back to like the core issue, which is really no one should be trained in just those. Mm. Now, of course, you can focus on one or more or different aspects. You have to focus, but generally what I would love in a few generations for us to be really puzzled at the science humanities distinction. And we're like,
right.
Remember when people thought those were like different things, like, you know, or
totally separate disciplines.
Yeah. And now I think that we're a long way from that in some ways, but we're on the cusp of something happening big in other ways.
Mm. So you say that the science, philosophy, and math grew up together. You've said, what do you mean? So can you explain that and unpack that a little bit?
Yeah.
So they're not viewed that way today. You're saying that they need to be again, and you hope for a time when they're not, that's a weird question.
Right.
But you're saying they were together.
Yeah. So this isn't just like, hey, I happen to have, hey, I have this new thing. How about we join them all, you know, like peanut butter right. and chocolate, you know, it's like, together. Yeah. And that's not how it was. It actually, when you look at the beginning of Western philosophy, so the Greeks, they were, you know, even Thales, the very first philosopher that we usually think is the beginner, was a scientist and a mathematician and what we call a philosopher. But it becomes much more obvious when you get to Plato, because really Plato, so much of his his philosophy was driven by mathematics and the view that the world is mathematical. So he had this, and he was getting all of this from the Pythagoreans. And we usually think about Pythagoras as like, okay, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. And that's about it. But it turns out that we wouldn't have Plato if it weren't for the Pythagoreans. And, you know, someone has said, you've probably heard this before, that all of European or Western philosophy is but a footnote to Plato. And so it's amazing how he set the agenda and had the questions. Just the fact that he was able to ask those questions is astounding.
Right.
But the other thing where his philosophy is driven by math and science. And we get the liberal art, what we call the liberal arts, from Plato himself.
Like Plato, that's where, the philosopher mathematician.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the Republic, he lays out the, you know, the education for the philosopher kings.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, here's what, in traditionally there's seven liberal arts. You know, you have the grammar, rhetoric, and logic. But then there's the four additional ones that Plato, and he lays those out in the Republic. These are what the leaders should be studying. Well, it turns out that that's really just the Pythagorean division of mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
But what's weird is their view of mathematics, his vision of mathematics, included things like music and aesthetics, and it was all interrelated.
Right.
Like mathematics and music were roughly the same thing. There's a music of the spheres, and it's beautiful, and you get that with someone like, say, Einstein, a Pythagoreanism and a Platonism like that, where he chooses the mathematics and the physics because it's beautiful. So this notion of beauty is got. So again, you think beauty and mathematics or beauty and science, and those two think music, those seem like such opposite ends of the spectrum. But it turns out that everything, if you look back at the beginning of Greek, you know, Western history,
right,
it was all one thing.
It almost sounds like you're describing math as almost the glue that held the, what we would consider the aesthetic arts together.
Very much so.
It was the tool, or it would be another way to say it.
Well, in the concept and the framework, it was really, and it wasn't just like, okay, I take these mathematical laws and apply them. It was, no, there's something fundamentally mathematical. Even if I didn't have the language for it, there are the world's mathematical itself, regardless of putting our concepts on it.
Right.
I mean, Plato and Pythagoras, and they would think, no, God just made, that's what he made the world like.
Right. Yeah. So it was like this until when? What happened? Why is it separated today?
Yeah, it's a longer story. The long answer, it was fits and spurts, and it wasn't uniform. Part of it had to do with lacking some of the mathematics to really be able to describe the world the way Plato wanted to. He wanted to describe motion and all, and they had some of that, but in order to have to really describe the world in a way that's detailed enough, you need a detailed language.
And so we have that today.
We do.
But it's separated.
Yeah, which is the irony of it all. I mean, the whole thing is it's one of those things where you don't STEM disciplines and the humanities back together, liberal, however you want to couch that, is not an ad hoc new thing that classical Christian educators made up or any,
right.
It was nothing like that at all. That's just how it was thought of initially. And we're just rediscovering that
with better tools
now. Yeah. And now we have much better tools. You know, once you get in the main, probably the, you know, there's all kinds of powerful tools along the way, but a tool that really just kind of ignited or maybe unlocked things was calculus. Because that's the mathematics of motion. And that's exactly what Plato wanted to describe. He wanted to describe mathematically motion,
right,
or change.
Okay.
And you need that, and you can do some powerful things without calculus, but calculus is so powerful that once you do that, it just unlocks all kinds of things.
So we developed calculus, And where did we start to separate the liberal arts? So when calculus was developed, would you say that during the development of calculus during the Enlightenment, that was when we started departing from this? Or did that happen later? How did that happen?
Yeah, again, it wasn't, it's not a super simple answer. There was still, you know, Newton had what we would call a classical or liberal arts education, right. And that's part of how he was able to do what he did. But he obviously focused on mathematics in certain respects where other people didn't. Even those who were physicists or scientists didn't all, you know, some people went into biology. Some people, yeah. And right. So there's a sense in which you're always going to have to focus on something.
Sure.
But I think we've totally misunderstood focus and emphasis and replaced it with division and siloing. Mm-hmm. And those are so different because really what you're doing is so someone like Newton couldn't have, or Einstein couldn't have done what they did without understanding the big picture and having that interconnectedness.
Right. So you're saying that the current liberal arts emphasis are misunderstanding the need for math and STEM, and the STEM are misunderstanding the need for liberal arts.
Yeah, and do you mean the lack of
the lack need? Of integration?
Yeah.
Meaning that they're siloed.
Yeah,
and they think that's good. That's my impression. So if you look at the just secular Christian, both sides, if you look at the liberal arts folks, they tend to be happy in their field, and they're mm-hmm. certainly not looking at the other. If you look at the STEM, they typically tend to deride liberal arts, and you're saying they're doing that to their detriment.
Yes, good, yeah, and like you said, both sides are doing that to their detriment. You need to understand math and science in order to understand the humanities and the liberal, and vice versa. So and this is one of the things when I talk to engineers and STEM educators, pointing out that no, really understanding philosophy and its importance and its history actually will make you a better scientist or engineer because you really understand more. Okay, things like evidence. Why is even the fact that the world can be described mathematically, when you start asking why would that be, we take it for granted,
right?
And you start that the Pythagoreans and Platonists did not take that for granted, and they were like, and most of the philosophers didn't. And so you even in the Enlightenment, you have Immanuel Kant saying, okay, we have Newton, we have calculus. How is that possible? And so much of Kant, and you normally don't think of people who study Kant as being into mathematics or physics,
right.
But that was really his critique of pure reason, is he's trying to explain or understand how humans can have mathematical knowledge and knowledge of Newtonian physics.
Hmm.
I would have never associated Kant with math and physics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a philosopher.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're saying that liberal arts students who are not necessarily interested in being scientists,
all those philosophy majors,
they need to be learning math. They need to be learning math. And you teach them math.
Yeah.
At New St. Andrews College, a liberal arts great books college.
Yeah.
What are they getting out of that?
It's been really a lot of fun to see over the last, 15 years, hearing students, you know, they, like you say, it's a liberal arts school.
Right.
So most of
they're
them
expecting books they're on most, philosophy yeah. and poetry.
We thought we were safe.
Exactly. And that's exactly the, and both of you are graduates from that college. It's like
yes, both of us have taken, both Daniel and I have taken Dr. Stokes classes.
I believe I was in your first math class at MSA.
Wow. It's you know, these students largely go there to escape. Yes. What I'm teaching. So, in one sense, it's like, man, this is like it's a captive audience. So it's a little bit of a hard sell. But at the same time, I think when students are finished, they're really surprised that there is this integration and that things like, how can we know? What can we know? All of those big questions, you know, what is beauty?
Mm.
All of those actually go back to Platonism and the study of mathematics. And that, but not only that, one of the things that, and this was something which I'm so grateful for, the school let me do.
Mm.
They let me do that. They take 8 weeks and go through calculus with these students some of whom have only had algebra.
Hmm.
You know, so I say, hey guys, we're going to do calculus. I mean, you're just like, okay, that, you know, we should probably have smelling salts here. And,
yeah. Uh-huh.
And it really is by the end of those 8 weeks, if you look at their final exam for that part of the course, they're doing real calculus.
They're doing it.
Yeah, it's like, there's no denying that they're calculus. So yeah, it's not.
And, right.
Yeah. And at the same time, I teach it in the context of how it relates all the way back to this story that begins with ancient Greek Western philosophy.
Right.
So it's not taught out of context. So that's one benefit.
Right.
The other benefit is a kind of pedagogy that I wish I had had when I was taught math.
Hmm.
And that's a different aspect to it.
Yeah, so actually this leads me to my next question, which is some of these students have only had algebra. Few of them, it sounds like, have had calculus before. And if I understand right, statistically only 14% of high school students in the United States study calculus. Why is, it seems like calculus is seen as a luxury, a delicacy, appreciated only by the mathematician connoisseurs, as you say in your Calculus for Everyone article in Digressio. Why is calculus this highly optional, almost never studied? I mean, 14% is a very small percentage. And should it be studied in high school? In other words, what do you want to see coming into your classroom?
Yeah, that's a great question.
There are a couple questions.
Yeah.
In there, so. and first of all, why are there so few?
Yeah,
that's the main question.
And I think, again, it's twofold. Not knowing the centrality of calculus and how it goes back to what Plato was doing and the questions he was asking and all, I think that's a big part of it. And I think the way we teach math has become such that it's really made it difficult. We just try to cover too many topics too quickly. And I think part of that comes from a lack of perspective, which ironically goes back to not understanding both the humanities and STEM, because you don't have this perspective where you know, okay, here are the high yield concepts for mathematics, let's say. And I didn't realize this until after I was finished with graduate school and as an engineer. And looking back, it took me years and years of studying philosophy and have seen the integration that I realized there are certain concepts that we covered, let's say, in, you know, a semester or even 2 weeks that were so central, and we should have focused on those And that would have laid the foundation for these other things, but you're just running by so quickly that you're just skimming the surface. And you, and I think STEM students, even STEM students, feel this kind of, you know, the disorientation. Imagine, you know, if you've water skied and you fall and you skim the surface, and right. you don't, that disorientation kind of, you just, that's how you go through your classes where you're trying to, even if you're good at them. I have this, I did very, very well at engineering and math and physics, but there was always this sense of, I'm just really not getting this. Hmm. Like in
even though you did well.
Yeah. Where you just think, wow, I just, by the skin of my teeth, according to the standard that I did understand it. But now looking back, it's like, you know, we should have totally slowed down and focused on these like handful of concepts as an aside. So we're
overwhelming the students.
Yeah. And it's an avalanche. And right. when everything is important, nothing is.
Right.
Right.
And I think that's just, and it's so sad to see.
So what's the antidote?
I think it's long-term, it's training people in both so they have this perspective and they understand, all right, here are the concepts that are most important.
Right.
And I don't mean just most important for understanding humanities or the history of the West. I mean even understanding how to be an engineer or how to be a physicist. So, for example, and this is for all of you people who have had, been in engineers or anything, differential equations, particularly the wave equation. If you've had a physics course, you know that wave equations are very, very, are something you study. You don't know necessarily that they're very important. Turns out that a simple wave equation ends up being, you know, you think, okay, waves, like maybe light and water waves. Okay. Well, it turns out that actually quantum mechanics, the actual description of fundamental matter, they use a wave equation. All of a sudden, once you realize, like, I really, looking back, wish I had studied that wave equation a lot more. Oh. And just been able to focus on it. Many concepts that I just don't ever come across or know. But there are a number of ones, and I've talked to engineers and scientists and who feel the same way. They're just like, yeah, we just covered so much. I wish we'd focused on this, that, or the other.
And you studied for years to find out what was actually the most important.
Yeah.
In what you studied.
Right. Yeah, I've heard that said that the definition of an expert is knowing what information to ignore.
That's
and
great.
So it sounds That's like great, yeah. there's a certain almost a certain aspect of the way we study calculus is a non-expert way in that we are not able to differentiate what's important.
Totally. Yeah. No, that's a great way of putting it.
So. Would you say everyone should study calculus?
Most definitely. And I think there's a, you know, that's obviously one of those things that calculus teachers or math teachers say in high school or junior high, or and I've heard this, like, look, you've not taught my students before. You know, I have some students that are really good and some students that there's no way I would put calculus in front of them.
Right. Well, 14% do. And therefore that means that's a lot of people who are not doing
it. Yeah. And I totally get that. And if you're thinking about teaching calculus in the way that it's normally taught and you're trying to do all that, yeah, of course. But so the way I do this, myself, the way I teach calculus
is calculus for everyone, understanding the mathematics of change.
Call now 1-800. Sorry. There really is
2000.
So there is this, and I did, you know, I after seeing this, I wanted to try this out. But what you have is there's a certain way of teaching calculus, for example, that gives the people who aren't going into the STEM disciplines and aren't, gives them what they need to understand what I would call the Shakespeare of mathematics. It's like, that's, you really just need to know what that is and understand why we had it. But at the same time, the same exact course can be used to ground the people who are going into STEM who will take a lot more calculus.
Right. Okay.
Because this is one of the things that I found is that I, you know, after taking years and years of calculus in undergrad and grad school, you know, different kinds of calculus based thing. If someone said, all right, well, what's the essence of it? The core, I wouldn't have really been able to say. I could have gestured at things. But now looking back, there's this core that helps both the people who are non-STEM and the people who are STEM understand it for different purposes. And sometimes for the same purpose too. You know, I mean, like there's some overlap for all the people who take it will understand why calculus is so important, but how it's also it shows so many of the different it's a manifestation of so many of the different philosophical issues.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's sort of, would you say that it is a capstone for the student who doesn't want to go into advanced math, but is wanting to round out, understand the world better, understand how, be given philosophical tools to see the world. And it is a platform for further development for the student who wants to be an engineer or scientist?
Entirely. Yeah. Okay. So it's for both people, and it's
it's for everyone.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and it sounds like, you know, I've had people joke about, you know, it's calculus for everyone else. And it's like, no, that's really not what I'm not joking. This isn't just calculus for people who can't do
real
calculus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's even if you've had calculus before, going back, even taking this and grounding yourself, calculus is just too important for STEM people to not deeply understand.
Right.
Like it needs to be in your core, because so much of the higher mathematics is based on the core of calculus.
Right. So you're saying a high school student might take this if they're not wanting to go into math, but let's actually kind of now go towards the student that wants to be make the next breakthrough in string theory, or wants to, I mean, they want to go, they want to change the world. They want to be they want to be on the front lines of scientific development. Where would you place calculus for everyone? Is this something that you'd place in their path?
Totally. I would.
And where would it fit in?
Right. And there might not be a one size fits all, but I would probably put it after maybe Algebra 2 or before pre-calc. One of the things with pre-calc is such an interesting, pre-calc by and large is a hodgepodge of concepts that you'll end up using in calculus, but that aren't necessarily related directly to calculus. So let's say it's you learn about different kinds of functions that you're going to be dealing with that you hadn't covered in previous courses, but regular calculus courses are going to deal with those. So you better get this grab bag of all. Mm-hmm. So you still have to have those concepts. So you can't avoid that. One of the things, and this is kind of how the book that I wrote is designed. It can also be used as a humanities/math/physics course that you could actually take simultaneously. So if someone who's going into STEM is probably fairly comfortable with math and not super struggling with some of the algebra and the manipulations.
Right.
This would be a fairly easy course in certain respects. So they could totally take that in addition to, let's say, a pre-calc or as they're taking trig or whatever it is, they're starting to get that first coat of paint on the core of calculus. So by the time they get to calculus, because that really is, like I said, you have to understand calculus. So everything just about is built off of that. And if you shortchange yourself on that, where you're just like skimming through it across, you know, and you're getting A's, but you're like, I'm kind of getting a, that's, calculus is too important to have that. You have to understand it deeply.
So one of the elements about the Calculus for Everyone course that I think is unusual. If you open up the text and you start reading it, you would probably not guess you're reading a calculus text or a math book. It feels like a philosophy textbook. So I've heard you use the phrase, the history of math is math. Can you tell us how that affects the way you wrote Calculus for Everyone? So how much is philosophy? How much is math? Or are those, again, should those never be separated?
Right. Well, it's interesting. I don't think they should be separated. And the fact that we're kind of surprised that that's one of the things tasks we have before us is to get rid of that. Like I said before, this wouldn't have, the fact that philosophy shows up in math wouldn't have necessarily surprised a lot of people in the past. That said, I think some people would be, they look at this and, you know, let's say they open to a page and they think, you know, this isn't really that technical. So it's probably not really, it's like, well, that's not true either, because you can really, if you can't simplify highly technical concepts, then you're probably not really understanding those. So what's really a challenge, and one of the things I enjoyed about this, was taking these concepts that you have to understand, and it's real calculus, and yet using words that, you know, putting them in the context that it's not just, you might sound like I'm dumbing it down, but that's actually not what I'm doing at all. It's taking it and explaining it in a way that allows you to really see what's going on.
Mm, right. I feel like there's a lot of fields where, like this, where it's the understanding the most basic principle is the breakthrough, the advanced breakthrough. You know, it's you know, again, an expert knows what information to ignore along those principles. And so that's what you're doing for math, instead of just having, you can have a really great math student who knows a lot of stuff and still missing the picture.
Right.
You say in your introduction, we're on the steep part of a learning curve, so our yield promises to be extremely high. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, it's when this happens not in lots of areas where you're learning, when you're first learning a discipline or a skill or something, you go from nothing to a much larger percentage than nothing. Even 1% is a big percentage change. But you tend to be at the stage where you're gathering information and it's making a huge difference.
Every little bit of information makes a huge
difference. Yeah, good. Yeah, right, exactly. And then, so rather than, we're not at the stages in education where we're sanding and refining. We're in the place where we're finding the objects to even work with at all. And it's like, oh, shoot, I have this entirely new tool. Like, okay, I'm sure we can perfect it and make it beautiful, much more beautiful down the line. But right now, it's such a step change from what we have that.
What is the change?
It's what calculus studies, the mathematics of change. Okay, what were you asking?
The learning curve of what? So what are we, like, what are, generally, what are we?
Yeah.
The learning curve.
Good.
We're on the steep part of the learning curve.
For math.
What is the learning curve?
Good. Yeah. Math education. I think now it's, when it comes to put, again, the two main things that that will be high yield, seeing that these concepts have a history And I mean, everyone knows that these concepts have a history.
Right.
That's not, you know, people know they showed up, and that's not what we're talking about, or not just what we're talking about. We're talking about, okay, what's that conversation, that ongoing conversation since the beginning of ancient cult that this is a part of? And then you find out, wow, it's a big part of that. So the historical and contextual aspect is one high yield thing that we're gaining. The other is more of a straight pedagogical, or at least a focusing. I mean, I think this is happening in all kinds of areas. If you read productivity literature and focus, you know, you've got to be, and it's not a new thing. You know, if you talk to basketball coaches, they'd much rather have someone that can dribble the ball in there, like they're just so good at it and it's so natural, than someone who doesn't really have that, but then also knows a bunch of different plays. Mm-hmm. You want people that know the basics really well. And I think that's one of the things it's ironic. We've tried to cover so much material that actually we don't know
as math,
the basics. Yeah. So there's that twofold thing that we're getting when it comes to math education that have high yield right now. Mm-hmm. And it's the contextual historical aspect, and we can focus on the right concepts at the right time.
Right.
And that's one of those things where it's, it's not just fewer concepts, slower. It's the right concepts at the right time, at the right pace. So it takes, and again, you have to have people who have seen the big picture, have been educated in multiple disciplines, maybe have worked in industry and seen what, you have to have someone who has seen and worked with the big picture, and yet at some depth, to be able to choose wisely which sorts of things to teach and not.
Right.
So if I can real quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
So basically you're saying that as we as the people who are teaching math have taught too many irrelevant concepts too quickly, and we have culturally ignored the historical, philosophical foundations of math. Have math and science been suffering because of the splitting up of these, you know, this philosophy and math science?
Yes. I think very much so. If you look again back at the beginning of the 20th century, and you have the development of quantum mechanics and general relativity, the folks who were involved in that, you know, Einstein, Bohr, Heisenberg, they knew that they were doing there were a lot of philosophical underpinnings for what they were doing. And they knew it. You know, Einstein knew his Hume, his Mach, his Kant. I mean, he knew, and he was consciously aware of that. Mm. And
so that actually informed his science. The philosophy informed his science?
Yes. And it informed people like Niels Bohr, who were the, you know, father of quantum mechanics. Today, we're at this weird place in physics where there's a controversy now, but it's called one way to put it would be the string theory wars, or the string is that we don't have a way to solve one of the biggest problems in physics. And there's been this kind of, if not stagnation, we haven't been able to get over this hurdle for decades now. And we've never had this kind of we've never had this kind of slowdown where in a problem that hasn't yielded eventually. And so someone like Lee Smolin, who was actually one of the people who, innovators of string theory. I mean, there are lots of, but he was one of them. Says that what we have now is we have lots of, in physics and math, lots of virtuosos, people who can do the math and do the physics and do that, but we don't have the visionaries like the Einsteins and the Bohrs. Mm. the people.
You called them craftspeople in your article.
Yeah. So you,
I thought it was an interesting term, that idea of someone who is tinkering on a very particular level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Versus visionaries.
Yeah. So I think Smolin calls them the virtuosos, meaning that they're just like, they can, but yeah, the craftspeople that can do some of the really amazing intricate work, but they're building on maybe putting the ladder up against the wrong wall. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, to change the metaphor, you know, they're building in the wrong place and creating something that's beautiful, but in the wrong section. And so, mm-hmm. what people like Smolin are saying is we need to really step back. We need to have, there have to be these visionaries, these kinds of philosophers, people who understand the philosophy, right. understand how it relates to science and math, mm-hmm. to say, hey, let's not put our ladder up against that wall, but let's try this wall.
Right. Yeah. I think this is something that some of the American tech CEOs have realized. I like quoting Steve Jobs from his the iPad 2 launch. Apple is known for creating so incredible engineering, but the engineering part isn't unique. There's a lot of incredible engineers who create amazing tools, but Apple has somehow made more human tools. And so he's famous for saying that during the iPad 2 launch keynote, he said it's by combining the liberal arts with the STEM fields that allows us to make products that make the heart sing. Mm. And so I think there are people who understand, and that's that, you know, so you can make an incredible calculator, you can make an incredible microprocessor, but are you able to be, you know, the seer or a visionary in a way that connects it to different fields? Maybe that's even just human nature and the way people interact with it, or maybe that's another science field or another crafts field. It's that connecting. So are you saying that's that? So even among scientific fields, there's just a kind of a siloing, a roadblocking, and it takes visionaries, seers, as Smolin calls them.
Right. Yeah.
And to cross over and actually build the building.
Yeah. And I think you bring out with the iPad talk that I think that's an additional aspect, much more culturally profound in certain respects. But like you say, even within say physics, there, you know, should we keep throwing one of the questions is, should we keep throwing all of these resources into string theory, for example, that doesn't even look like we're going to have experiments that could decide between different versions of string theory? But I mean, there are big picture questions that need to be answered.
Yeah.
And I think they're just now realizing that it's like, okay, we need to step back and so it's not even just the siloing between the technicians. It's a different kind of physicist or scientist altogether.
So what you're saying is that if we want to get past this roadblock in string theory in these STEM fields, we need more visionaries and less crafts people.
Yes.
In these fields. And the way to do that is to understand the interdisciplinary aspect of the, so get calculus for everyone.
Yeah. Well, it may not be an either or, you know, but you need more visionaries now, and you need the people. And I think we're at a place where we are ripe for this. It is, particularly classical Christian ed, where we have in just private education generally, you have the freedom to make these big changes that are going to be high yield, and this is the time to make them. I mean, I'm just amazed that it's all coming together at this time. And you see this too when it comes to, you know, I don't want to bring up but COVID and all the debates over this science, or there are all the arguments, but so many of the arguments, on no matter what side the person's on, it's been disconcerting because you have people who don't either understand the nature of scientific evidence or don't understand the nature of epistemology and how you know things, even if they are scientists. Right. You think, you know, that's just not how even science works.
Right.
Yeah, right. And so knowing the philosophy, knowing the epistemology.
Or human nature.
Yeah.
In other words, there's often those who are, for example, saying, you know, you shouldn't be, you should be, you know, what's your problem with science? You know, go wear a mask, stay home, you know, do all these things. They're not balancing the aspect of what it means to be a human being or to, you know, life at all costs, what it means to live. There's so many questions that I feel that COVID has brought up that we're not prepared. We don't have the tools to even discuss. I think that's a great example.
Yeah. No, and it goes back to, okay, what kinds of things do you value? You know, it's and what are the means to those values? And just knowing that that's even a question, because in a lot of the debates, people are answering or trying to answer these questions, but they don't actually know a lot of times that they're answering a question, or they've assumed answers to questions that's where the real disagreement
you're giving these solutions to these questions. Are those even the right questions?
Yeah.
Right. And you have to be able to back up and see the big picture.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, that could be a whole thing all by itself.
Do you think that if we are able to, especially because we're, you know, so close to the classical Christian movement, if we start getting this right, this integration of math with philosophy, do you think that it would be a leap to say that classical Christian educators in schools and families could be the ones to produce this next generation of scientists that are solving these problems? Do you think that that's likely? Kind of a...
How about this? That's one of the things that drives me is the hope of that and the possibility. I think that is entirely possible and not pie in the sky. It's something that we have a unique opportunity that people haven't had. There's everything from the felt need. We're starting to see and you get this in all quarters of education. I think it really is something that within a couple of generations, you can, a huge change in the culture would be seen. Mm.
That's very exciting stuff.
Yeah. So on a very practical note, a head of school, maybe they have a curriculum in place, you know, homeschool parents who are wanting to integrate this and perhaps use calculus for everyone, or even just take some of these principles. What would be your advice to them, especially the institutions that already have things in place that are the, I was about to say the old way, but it's the new way. We're trying to go back to the old way. but that are, you know, who say, I really like what you're saying about the need. I recognize it. What would you say, advice would you give them for implementing some of this in their school? As simple as, you know, use this curriculum. Where do they use it? What grade? Right. I mean, some of the more practical questions.
Yeah, I've had that. One of the things that instigated this book is when I would go and I would talk about this, people would say, okay, well, what can you give me? Yeah. You know, where would point me to something and
integrate math and philosophy.
Yeah.
Great. What is that?
Right.
How would you ever do that?
Just tell me the problem, man.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So when I would say, so part of this, the reason for writing this book is to give by way of, rather than just telling, showing and saying, look, here's one of the ways in a very clear example, concrete way of how to do it differently. Mm-hmm. And so even getting this, I think we could make so much headway. And I would advise just adding this, you know, if you say, there's no way I'm going to cut out any of my math classes. We can't do that because we have kids that are going on to apply for different college. And that's a real issue. I mean,
right.
I would say add this as add something like this curriculum to as a humanities or something that bridges it. And I think once you do that, we're at the high yield place where this kind of change will be. I think it'll be so new and exciting that people will just be, oh my gosh, I didn't know this is how. And then that will, I think, spring other people and other teachers to start implementing it more in their own ways. Mm. And, you know, 'cause this is a large team effort, but just getting this into the hands of teachers and homeschoolers, even to take a look at it, I think will be a big step forward, because I think this will resonate with people who have been in STEM. Mm. I think it's going to resonate with those people. And I think it'll resonate also with the people who haven't been in STEM, but know that there's something wrong.
Right.
And try it. I mean, I really do think, like I said, you could do this if you had to, you could do it in a semester.
Right. Mm. So you said as a humanities, and I think that's from the perspective of what do you drop or add. So, but my question next is, does the humanities teacher teach this or the math teacher teach it? Or is that just part of the problem that we have versus humanities teachers?
This would be something that I think a math teacher would teach. I do think that it's also written so that if someone didn't have a teacher, let's say a student, it's written so that a student could sit through this and read it themselves.
Right. Mm.
So it doesn't
info dump.
Yeah. So in that sense, if you had, it really wouldn't need a math teacher. It would need someone to make sure that the students were doing, you know, like typical homeschool kind of thing. Right. But if you had someone, I know, there's one case, my kids are taking two of my youngest kids are taking this class this year, but another teacher is teaching it. Mm-hmm. And that teacher is a math teacher. Mm. And that really is great for them to have that kind of background as well.
Right.
So I think there's a benefit to having that. And I think too, the math teacher math teachers, because of the way they've been trained, I think they will also really, really enjoy it. It's one of those things where we're like, yes, exactly.
Mm. So this will actually, reading this, having this textbook, Calculus for Everyone, will actually help even the non-math types understand why are we taking math?
Totally.
Understand the whole point.
Right.
Get them to actually enjoy answering some of these questions. And
yeah,
and it will immediately, if they do that in terms of the overall curriculum, we're going to already be messing with categories, because you'll have, you know, you go to an education conference and someone has their tag, you know, math department,
right,
humanities department. They're going to have to put both on.
Yeah, right, exactly.
We're going to start messing with people's categories day one. No, that's good. So you just said a math teacher would be the one who would teach it, even if it's as a humanities. Let's talk about homeschoolers. Mm. Can a average homeschool parent, mom or dad, teach this course? What would be their what prerequisites or preparation would you recommend or are required for it?
Yeah, I do think that a homeschooling parent could teach this course if they've been teaching, let's say they've been going, you know, they taught the algebra section. Mm-hmm. If they didn't already have done it, they probably need to remind themselves, okay, how do you, so you, X squared, what does that mean? You know, there would have to be some of that sort of review to get back in the algebra groove.
So algebra one is a prerequisite for the parent as well as the student.
Right.
Do you have to say, I remember you mentioned, as you're mentioning putting it together for maybe a STEM person, would you say algebra 2 should also be a prerequisite, or it would just be nice?
I think it would be, the reason I said that is because it would be closer to their next calculus course. Yeah. So so you wouldn't want it to be like 8 years before their, you know, whatever you want it, because it'd be easy to forget.
I see. So it's more fresh on their mind.
So it's fresher.
A math person for their next.
Because if they're going to, let's say they're going to take calculus in their senior year, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they're, it'd be nice to have it in their junior year or their sophomore or sophomore year.
Okay. So algebra one is kind of really all you have to have in order to do calculus for everyone.
Yeah.
And then if you're going to go on, it might be nice to have the next calculus closer after that. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And what's nice about it too, is it puts an extra coat of paint on the algebra one material.
Nice.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on and answering
these questions. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. To the audience listening, if you have any questions for Mitch, feel free to submit them to the link in the show notes, and we'll see if we can get Mitch back on to answer them, or maybe we'll publish a video or something like that. So submit questions. And don't forget to check out Calculus for Everyone on our website. There's a link also in the show notes. Thank you for listening to the Digressio podcast. Until next time, read your Bible, read a good book, and keep inheriting the humanities.